Hello and welcome to the Project Elected podcast. If this is your first time joining us, Project Elect is a nonpartisan nonprofit whose goal is pretty simple. We want to get more Latter-day Saint women involved in public service. My name's Audrey Perry Martin. I'm the founder of Project Elect, and on this podcast, I have interesting conversations with incredible LDS women who have held public office. So we really have a treat in store for us on this week's podcast. I'm joined today by Elizabeth Harmer Dion, and I am thrilled to have her here to talk with us about not only her impressive background, but also her journey in public service. Thank you so much for being here today, Elizabeth.
Totally my pleasure. And for those who are listening in, I'm a big fan of Audrey's, who about 4 weeks ago gave me some really, really good legal advice on elections law. And we can get into that story later if interested. But I think this is an example of women generally, but LDS women specifically, networking and helping each other out, because we have a lot to learn and a lot to teach each other.
Absolutely. I love that. And I think it's extremely important for LDS women to find each other and help each other, especially where there's not that many of us involved in government and politics and public service. So I think that's great. And Project Elect really wants to be that place where we can gather. So thanks for that, Elizabeth.
Yeah, and I think there are reasons for that that are specific to LDS women and LDS culture. And another thing that maybe we'll get into later.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely want to talk to you about that. But first, I want to ask you to introduce yourself, because your background is so interesting. You've done so many cool things, and then you have done all this local public service as well. So if you could just kind of tell us your journey and how you got there and your background and all the cool stuff you've done. Well, probably not everything you've done, but just some highlights.
So the word I've used to describe myself is peripatetic, meaning I've wandered a whole lot of places, and it's been really fun and quite varied. And whether it's political science or history, we talk about lumpers and splitters. And lumpers tend to look at a lot of ideas. Splitters tend to go very deep. So I'm broad. I hope I'm deep in some areas, but certainly broad. And maybe the thing that you can learn from my life and example is anything you can do can ultimately be useful in another undertaking. So very quickly, I grew up in California and Utah, came out to Massachusetts when I was 18, attended Wellesley College, felt like I'd landed on the moon. It was really, really far from my experience. And yet in some ways, also felt for the first time that I really belonged as a very nerdy, very cerebral girl, not popular, didn't know how to speak teenager. And so Wellesley really, in some ways, despite how foreign it felt, also felt like home. So studied English and political science there, was a sufficient nerd that I won a Marshall Scholarship to go study at the University of Cambridge for a couple of years. So was at King's College, University of Cambridge, got a master's degree in political theory, jumped back to California to go to law school, Stanford, and then landed back in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and in later years did another political science degree at Boston College. But landed in Cambridge because of my husband's career. And he's got a wild story. Suffice it to say, it was not obvious that a boy who grew up on a farm in Jerome, Idaho, and didn't know that there were things called deadlines for college applications, ended up doing a PhD at MIT. And so we are both examples of unlikely journeys. But Keith is very involved in biotechnology. And biotech really happens in Cambridge, Massachusetts. That is the center of the world in biotech. And he's 12 years older than I am, was much further advanced in his career. And so for a lot of really practical reasons, we prioritized his career. That had a lot of implications for me. And every time that we looked at leaving, and he was great. There are times when he was actually willing to prioritize my career. And for various reasons, we didn't. And I'll get into those later as well. They have to do with special education. And not only is Cambridge the center of biotechnology, but Massachusetts is probably the best place in the world for special education. We have an autistic son. So there are things that can drive your life and your career that you never saw coming. Anyway, I had always thought that I would run for public office, but that was going to be in a place in the West, probably going back home to Utah, where there was a comfortable fit and I had connections. It was never going to happen in Massachusetts, especially Cambridge, Massachusetts, which vies with San Francisco for being the furthest left city in the United States. And certainly was able to do a lot when we lived in Cambridge, and actually had a lot of respect, despite the fact that I didn't fit in politically. But it was a dry well in terms of running for public office. Belmont, we moved to Belmont about 11 years ago, was a little easier. I'm going to stop there and see if you want to ask some questions, because I feel like I've talked for a long time.
Well, I do, because you are elected member of the town meeting, is what it's called in Belmont, Massachusetts. And you chair the committee, Community Preservation Committee, and the Warrant Committee, which you told me is the Finance Committee, which is fascinating to me. And I would love to hear a little bit more about your town, about Belmont, about how these town meetings, town councils work, because it's fascinating. As a fellow political science nerd, I love this kind of stuff, the New England, you know, town meetings and the true democracy that goes on there. And if you could tell us a little bit about how that works, I'd love it.
So town meeting is democracy at the grassroots level. And when Alexis de Tocqueville wrote Democracy in America, he was really writing about New England. And he was especially fascinated by this thing called town meeting. Literally, town meeting is the legislative body of the town. And depending on the size of the town, every member of the town may be a member of town meeting. And they show up for annual town meeting and vote on all the bylaws for the town and vote on the town's budget. As towns got larger, and there are also cities in Massachusetts, and if you're a city, that just means you don't have town meeting. You've got a different form of government, which is a city council and a mayor. If you're town meeting, you've got a select board and town meeting. And so Belmont's divided into 8 precincts. Each precinct elects 36 members to town meetings. So when you put us all together, there's 288 of us who come together in the spring and again in the fall. We debate every budget item. No money can be appropriated without town meeting agreeing to it. Wow. And so it is this really fascinating exercise in local democracy. The other thing that tends to happen with town meeting is you have lots and lots and lots of citizen committees. Mm-hmm. And in Belmont, that means over 50 committees with over 300 people serving on them. And they can be as obscure as the Shade Tree Committee or as significant as the Capital Budget Committee or the Community Preservation Committee. So they really, really range in importance. Some of these committees are standing committees, some are ad hoc. For instance, we're trying to build a community path through Belmont, a bike path through Belmont. And so there was the community path. There was a committee to study the community path, and now there's a new committee to implement the community path.
Okay.
So town meeting is fun, but also can drive you nuts because it is open mic. We have a town moderator, and he does run a pretty tight ship. But really, until someone calls the question, everybody can stand up for their 2 minutes and pontificate about whatever matters before town meeting. What is great about this is you learn a lot about people and a lot about the town. And I would say what it really functions as, and this is something that Tocqueville liked about it, it is a means of citizen education. It means that in Belmont, we have lots and lots and lots of people who know a lot about what's going on in the town, and they then turn and educate their friends and neighbors. So the advantage of something like this is that it really does engage people. It really does educate them. The disadvantage is that it's very inefficient, and it also means that there's so much going on at so many levels, it's really tough to know where to go for the information that you want.
Okay.
And people will complain, there's this cabal and there are these conspiracies and they're trying to keep information from us. Nothing could be further from the truth. Every single committee functions in complete compliance with the state's open meeting law. Mm-hmm. What people are really complaining about is you somehow haven't read my mind and told me the information that I want and then packaged it in such a way that I can digest it in 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. With this type of governance, you do have to invest time. And often what ends up happening is a lot of us end up being bellwethers or vectors for our friends and neighbors. They look at me and say, I know you know what's going on. Who do I vote for? Mm-hmm. I know you know what's going on. What do I do? Mm-hmm. And so there is actually quite a bit of trust that is involved in this as people look to you for guidance on what to do on things that really do matter. An example being a $300 million debt exclusion. $300 million was really $295 million. I was rounding up. And that $5 million doesn't matter. People will tell you if you have a problematic. And I thought for a number of reasons that it was a good idea, but that's a really major debt load for a town our size to take on. And it did pass, but it mattered that people felt that they could trust people who knew what was going on and why this was a necessary and good idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but there's a couple things that I just love about what you said. First of all, that, I mean, I live in California, and it's obviously nothing like that. It's a traditional city council governance and school boards and all of that. But that the person in charge of the meeting is called the town moderator. He or she is just moderating the meeting. They don't have any great power over anybody else. It's all this equal area, and that so many people attend these meetings. I mean, that's amazing to me, because, you know, we have elections here and nobody knows anything about what's going on. And, you know, I'm maybe one of the few people who pay attention. And so people come to me, like you said, to ask who to vote for and what's going on. But I, you know, that's amazing to me. I would love that if my town operated like that and so many people would actually attend these meetings and be involved and know what's going on, instead of just when they get their ballot thinking, who do I vote for? I don't know any of these names or any of the issues.
And Belmont's special in some ways in that it's one town over. We are this funny little town, a third of which is open space. We are 8 miles from the State House. We're right next to Cambridge, which is some of the most expensive real estate in the world. We get a lot of spillover. There's just there's Nobel laureates who live here. A huge number of Harvard and MIT professors live here. So it's a highly educated citizenry who really, really do care. Our underfunded schools, and I will say we're overtaxed and underfunded, and that's another complicated factor, because we don't have commercial real estate. We're trying to run a town and a school system on a residential tax foundation, which is really tough to do.
Yeah.
And that's something I get into as a member of the warrant committee, which we can talk about. And I mentioned Community Path, which we can talk about with the Community Preservation Committee. But just to give you an idea of what Belmont is. So this was Mitt Romney's hometown when he was governor, and also when he was running for president. It's Clayton Christensen's home. He passed away a few years ago, but Clayton Christensen was the world's foremost business theorist. Kim Clark, who was president of BYU-Idaho, and then a 70 came out of here. Clark Gilbert came out of here. Steve Wheelwright came out of here. So it whether it's in the church or just in Massachusetts, Belmont hits further than its weight, meaning it's a population of about 27,000, but it looms kind of large. That said, there are a number of other towns that have this similar profile. Lexington, which is right next door to us, Arlington. Lexington and Arlington, famous for Revolutionary War, but also much more recent history than that. And you'll find towns all through Massachusetts that have this same governance structure. And that's also because Massachusetts is very highly educated, and comparatively speaking, people are highly engaged. They really do care about their government and their schools and their communities.
Yeah.
So I think it does go hand in hand with a well and highly educated citizenry. Massachusetts has had for a while now the strictest, the highest academic standards that local communities have to meet, and that students do have to take something called MCAS. These exams that they take year after year that help the state know how communities are doing in terms of just foundational education for their students.
Right. It sounds great. I love it. I lived in Boston for a little while when I was working on the Romney campaign, and it was such a fun place to live. I obviously didn't get involved in the town meetings, but I, you know, just the way this works is so interesting to me. And like we have an HOA where I live, people don't even return their ballots. Like the apathy that I see where I live and other places in the country, it's really discouraging to me. So it's nice to know that there are still places where citizens are engaged and active. And I'm kind of hopeful now, though, because I feel like with all the issues with COVID, where local governments were key, that people have tuned in a little bit more to their local governments than they have been before. And I hope that increases instead of just falls away.
Yeah, so I love local government. And I always thought I was going to run. Just a little background. My father was a state senator in California from 66 to 74. He was the leader of the Senate Republicans and worked on a daily basis with Ronald Reagan. And then he was very instrumental when Bob Bennett decided to run for the Senate in the 90s. My father was very involved in that campaign. So I've seen a lot of high level state and national politics. That's where I always thought I was going to be. Mm-hmm. And then my life ended up somewhere entirely different. But there is intense satisfaction in working at a local level and really making a tangible difference in people's lives. So one of the things that I do is I chair the Community Preservation Committee. And I came there in a roundabout way. As a member of town meeting, there are 14 of us of the 288 who are appointed to something called the Warrant Committee. Mm-hmm. The Warrant Committee is basically the financial watchdog for town meeting. And people think we're very powerful. We're not. All that we do is advise town meeting how to vote on budget issues or any financial issues. That is our charge. Town meeting tends to listen to us, which is why we have soft power, but our hard power is literally limited to a $400,000 a year budget for emergency appropriations in the event the town meeting can't meet to approve an appropriate funding. And usually what we're funding is overtime for snow and ice removal. And every now and then, maybe if legal expenses go over the budget, then we'll approve some money for legal expenses. However, there's this other committee called the Community Preservation Committee, and Massachusetts has a statute called the Community Preservation Act, where if communities voluntarily assume a 1-3% surcharge on their local property taxes, the state will give a partial match, but these funds have to be used for recreation, open space, historic preservation, or affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And the Community Preservation Committee and the Warrant Committee were always at loggerheads because the Warrant Committee kept saying, "You're totally reactive. We need to see some planning. What's happening with this money? You just seem to be giving it out willy-nilly."
Right.
And the Community Preservation Committee saying, "Well, our charge is to respond to the petitions that are brought before us." So long story short, the Select Board ended up appointing me as a Warrant Committee member to the Community Preservation Committee. And within a year and a half, by dint of being the only willing person, I was now chairing this committee.
Fantastic.
And having been frustrated with what I saw as a lack of planning, I was kind of trying to nudge the Community Preservation Committee. And as I worked with these very dedicated members, began to see their concerns and their political realities. And one of their political realities is it's really tough to say no in a vacuum. Without a master plan and without knowing what our other commitments might be, we were just sitting on this pot of money that had to be used for these specific purposes. So if somebody came with an idea that fell within one of these purposes, it was really tough, almost impossible to say no. So the two things that I did were, first of all, I started beating the bushes. Well, I did a whole bunch more than that. I rewrote our plan to make it very explicit, to make some policies very explicit that were going to benefit long-term planning. Also rewrote the policies in such a way to ensure that projects had to go through a lot more vetting than they had gone through before. So for instance, if it was a recreation project, if the Recreation Commission hadn't held a proper set of hearings, we were not going to approve it. If it was an historic project at the Historic District Commission, some of these 50 committees that I've been talking about in Belmont, if it hadn't gone through their vetting process, we weren't going to approve it. And that was sort of understood, but not explicit. So I just made it much more explicit because it gave us cover to say no. We could say, "Hey, this hasn't gone through the proper process. We're saying no." So that's the first thing that I did, was I revised a lot of our policies. The second thing that I did was start proactively reaching out to groups that I knew had these big projects looming to say, "I need you to start asking for money preemptively. You may not be ready, but we have a year-long process before you can get funded, because you have to go through basically 5 months of hearings and then all of town meeting, and then it becomes available. The money doesn't become available till the beginning of the next fiscal year."
Right.
So the two areas where I got this to happen were community housing or affordable housing, where our affordable housing stock is in dire condition, needs to be rebuilt. Mm-hmm. We can never afford to rebuild that. But what we can do is, if we design the affordable housing, we are then in a position to get tens of millions of dollars in state and federal grants. So Belmont will never be able to, and I'm going to guess that by the time we're done rebuilding our affordable housing, it's going to be $70 to $80 million. If we can invest about $2 million in these planning funds, major multiplier effect, which to me looks like a really useful way to implement this very important but relatively small pot of money. So the community, the Belmont Housing Authority did start reaching out. They started with some redesigns, and then I said, I want you to start asking for more money, because they needed to do deeper design. It's a long, complicated story, but they've started doing that. Another example of this is the community path that I mentioned earlier, which is this bike path. There are bike paths all over Massachusetts. Belmont is a black hole because we don't have a bike path that goes through. So we don't connect Cambridge, which is one of the most densely populated areas, to all the rest of the western suburbs. Mm-hmm. So if we could come up with a community path design, once again, we can get, probably by the time it's done, this community path will cost about $30 million, which for a very short segment of path is crazy expensive, mm-hmm. but we're having to retrofit it and reverse engineer it. So it is really expensive because we're having to do what nobody thought would be done. Yeah. But again, if we spend about, by the time we're done, I'd say $2 to $2.5 million on design funds, we're going to get $30 to $40 million in construction funding that, again, we could never afford to do. So that's an example of local governance where I, as a member of this, as the chair of this committee, am a really key piece in ensuring that Boston and Cambridge are connected by bike paths to all of the western suburbs. That's kind of a big deal. I am helping to ensure that up to 200 families can stay in deeply affordable housing in Belmont. That's a really big deal. So no, I'm, you know, does the Boston Globe pay any attention to me? No. But at the end of the day, do I know that I made a big difference? Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And that's just some stuff we've done. There are other things that I can talk about that we've done as well, but those are two really obvious places where at the end of the day, I'll have ensured that my town gets probably over $100 million in state and federal funds for really important infrastructure.
Yeah, that somebody who wasn't as engaged and aware and as knowledgeable as you probably would never have figured that out. So that's amazing to be able to do that and take just a little pot of money and expand on it so that you can
leverage and multipliers. I'm all about leverage and multipliers. And that actually gets to another, you had sent a list of really impressive and thoughtful questions before we started that I did look through. And one of the questions you had asked is what do people know about local governance? Well, one of the things that they need to know is it's not ministerial. You're not just showing up and cutting ribbons. It is real work. And if you want to be effective, you need to be willing to get into the weeds and do some homework.
Yeah.
And that's true whatever level of government you're at. And I don't mean to be partisan, but I think it's pretty well known that Kamala Harris is not effective in her role as vice president. And a major reason for that is because she doesn't actually read the briefs that her staff prepares. And this is why she's had turnover, very high turnover of highly talented staff. You know, Barack Obama, before he ran for president, nobody was jumping ship from his office because they knew he was a rising star. Mm-hmm. Harris is not a rising star. And a major reason for that is she does not do her homework and she's notorious for it. So whether it's me at the local level or Kamala Harris in the vice president's office, you have to do your homework. You're not just showing up. Nobody cares that you're a pretty face. What they care about is, do you do the work and can they trust your word when you say something is so?
Mm-hmm. And that you know what you're talking about. Yeah, exactly. And that's such a good point. And thank you for making that, because I feel like people often don't want to do local government because they think of the election. They're like, oh, I don't want to run for office. That sounds difficult. And then what do I even do? What's even the point? And I feel like once you get into it and see these issues and see ways you can help, and if you're actually engaged and want to help, you can do amazing things like you clearly have been able to do. And that's so important to explain to people so that they realize they're not wasting their time in local government. There are big things they can do that really can improve their life and the lives of their community. And it's such a great way to serve. I really like looking at public service like you're doing as community service, because in the church, absolutely. We talk about, you know, we talk about community service and helping others and all of this stuff, but it feels like people don't think that running for office can be like that.
Service, I spend probably a third of my professional time on uncompensated local government. None of us are paid for what we do. It is all volunteer hours. And it's a huge service that I'm giving to my community. It's absolutely community and public service.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can really make a difference in the position that you're in, because you are a person who does their homework and knows what's going on and figures things out and is willing to put in the time, and you've made a huge impact. And I think that's such a great story. And I am so, you know, inspired by that, because it's hard. People are really into national politics. They sometimes are into state politics, but they don't realize that getting involved in local politics is really a place where they personally could make a huge impact just as one person.
A point to make about community service and local service is that it does take time. It does take time to get up to speed on issues, and sometimes it does feel like herding cats. I happen to have had an easier time with the Community Preservation Committee than my predecessor did as chair, and she's a wonderful woman and is still very available to me because she's a huge resource. But I just happen to know where more of the political sensitivity points are in town. And knowing that, I could steer around them or preempt them. And that's simply because I've been involved in this long enough to see what those issues are. And then I had wanted to say one other thing that I did as chair of the Community Preservation Committee. So one was that I changed policies. Two, I started reaching out to constituencies and asking them to preemptively ask for money. But the last thing that I did was we had some administrative funding that I used to commission a really big study. It was an asset inventory and condition study of all our recreation assets. And they did basically what's a 30-year study. And that document is golden. And the reason that it's golden is there is more need than we will ever be able to fund. What that means is if ever I get a frivolous project, I can say, oh, so sorry, I've got to rebuild these soccer fields. Can't do it. So we no longer have to say no in a vacuum, but it also is important because it means, given that we know that these projects are coming down the pipeline, we'll save money for them. This inventory and condition study that we did for recreation assets was extremely important in terms of, for want of a better phrase, giving us political cover. So that we weren't saying no in a vacuum, that we could really point to this rational lineup of projects and say, oh, this is a wonderful project that you have, but it just doesn't rise to the level that these others do. And in the coming year, we plan to do the same thing for our historic assets. Belmont has a lot of historic assets that need a lot of attention. We particularly have chimney problems. The chimney on Town Hall was going to fall down, and then the chimney on a library that was built of fieldstone was going to fall down. And these are both historic buildings. So trying to get these condition studies done so that nobody dies from falling fieldstone or brick off an historic asset. So I think you had also wanted to talk about LDS women in particular. And barriers there might be to local politics or politics generally. Do you maybe want to say a few words on that, and I can give you my perspective?
So I feel like I talk to a lot of women. I ask a lot of women to run for office, LDS women usually. And I feel like the answer I get most of the time is either an outright, no, I would never do that. Or I'm not thick-skinned enough for that. I'm not thick-skinned enough for politics. I couldn't do it because it would, you know, be too emotional. And I'm wondering what your response would be to that. I know you've worked for your campaign and then other people's campaigns a lot too. So what do you tell women if they say something like that to you?
First of all, they're not wrong. That, yeah, it can be really uncomfortable to be up there taking the arrows. What is helpful? One of the other really great questions you asked before this interview is, what's the best insult I've ever received? And I don't know that I can point to an insult, but what I can say is when I'm being criticized by a particular group of people, I'm proud of that because it means that I've gotten under the skin of people who I think don't have integrity or who don't work in a certain way. And if I've upset them, that means I'm doing the right thing in the right way. Mm-hmm. To develop a thick skin, you really have to depersonalize it. You've got to be more committed to the cause than to your own self-esteem. And I will take and can take a lot of arrows if I'm working towards something I really believe in. Mm-hmm. I will also say, in fairness to LDS women, we have an entire additional layer of arrows, which is Latter-day Saints. It's still okay to mock Latter-day Saints in a way that it's not okay to mock really any other denomination. Mm-hmm. So we'll take an added layer of criticism, of heat, of judgment. That's just the fact. There's a reason that there's a Book of Mormon musical and not a Quran musical. It's okay to mock us. It's not okay to mock Muslims. And not that I want to be mocking other religions, but yeah, there is an added layer of judgment. There's a flip side to that as well, though, which is so often people in Belmont will say to me, I am so impressed by the LDS community, mm-hmm. that we work so hard in the schools, that we really are known for being upright, that people notice the fact that it was Mitt Romney who was willing to criticize some of the things that the Trump administration did, that there is a level of integrity that transcends personal convenience. Mm-hmm. We are known for having that integrity, and in the same way that it can draw heat, it can also draw gratitude and praise. And I think if you can look at both sides of that, it can maybe give you the purpose that you need. And frankly, never underestimate the power of inspiration, discernment. I can do hard things if I have a spiritual conviction that I'm supposed to be doing it. Mm-hmm. Boy, it just makes a lot of the rest of the stuff fall away. So if I feel that this is something that I'm supposed to be doing, that the Lord is pleased with my service, I can answer to God in a way that really does let me zone out the fuzz and the static of everybody else. That there is that direct line of communication that we claim.
Yeah,
and that can be enormously helpful. And it can really help me sleep peacefully at the end of the day, knowing that I didn't have to make anyone proud but God today. And I did. Because God sees my heart and my purposes and what I was trying to do. And that's also an extra benefit we can claim, that there is, I think, an expansion of our minds and our spirits and our abilities that comes through covenant living and following the commandments, that we are given the ability to magnify our talents and work mm-hmm. with them. A couple of other factors that I think can make it challenging for LDS women, we follow perhaps more traditional gender roles than others might, and don't underestimate the amount of time that local politics can take. And if you're still raising children, that's tough.
Yeah.
And hey, nothing matters more. Having just come through COVID and seeing a lot of kids crash and burn, never underestimate the importance of what you're doing in your own home, but also recognize the skills that has given you. We were talking, 3 weeks ago, I was with the Doty campaign at a very contentious Massachusetts State Republican convention, and we were the non-Trump candidate against the Trump candidate, and it was very contentious. And I was really out of my comfort zone. I started out as a corporate attorney. I'm now a special education attorney. I had showed up as an elections law attorney. Talk about feeling like imposter and a fraud and having to bluff. And it turned out that what was really important, and huge thanks again to Audrey for the advice she gave me the week before I showed up, jumping into something new. Really what was important was issue spotting. And boy, as moms, do we issue spot all day every day. So there are a lot of soft skills that LDS women have. And boy, we know how to speak in public. It is amazing how many people are completely petrified to speak in public. And we've done it since primary. Mm-hmm. So it's just not that big a deal. And we can speak off the cuff. And we are really good at organizational cooperation and leadership, because we've done it through primary and Relief Society and Young Women or service projects. There's a whole set of soft skills. So I would really strongly advise LDS women not to underestimate themselves and have the courage to jump in with 2 feet. You've really got some skills that you may not appreciate and that others will see and value.
Yeah. I think that point about skills is so important. I think we don't always realize when we're developing these skills, especially in church service. So my daughter just got into Young Women's, and she got a call from a member of the bishopric to speak in sacrament meeting. And I was listening to their conversation. I could kind of hear both sides of it. And he wants her to talk on Father's Day about families. And she's like, oh, yeah, that's not a problem. Okay, that sounds great. No big deal. And I was just laughing because she's going to talk to, you know, hundreds of people publicly. She's never done it before. And she's so excited about it because she's been giving talks her whole life in primary and she's so comfortable with it. And we just train, we're trained from a very young age to be able to do these things, to lead, to speak in public, you know, to issue spot, to solve problems, to do it in a way that is not offensive and is collaborative, and all of these skills that we get that we maybe don't realize we're getting when we're serving in the primary or serving in Relief Society and Young Women's and all the other ways that we serve in the church, that really are exactly what you need to be a good public servant, and especially in local office. So I think that's a, thanks for bringing that up.
You mentioned something that I also think we bring to the table. We are taught from a very young age that everyone's a child of God and that God's love is unconditional. And I think and hope that that allows us to attack ideas but not people, or to attack policies but not people, or to look at something and say, hey, I may disagree with you on this, but I can agree with you on something else. And in a really highly polarized time, I hope that gives us the ability to find ways to work together. For whatever reason, the extremes control both parties right now. But the majority of America, not just the majority, the vast majority of America is somewhere in the middle. And there's a lot of common ground that we can find. And I do think that's a natural result of what we're taught from a very young age and what we firmly believe, that, that Christ died for all of us, not just some of us.
Yeah. Absolutely. And to just go back to the thick-skinned question and whether LDS women are thick-skinned enough, I feel like you said, we do have additional arrows directed at us, you know, being Latter-day Saints, being women, those things make us more prone to get attacked, but it doesn't make us more vulnerable to attacks. And we have these extra protections that you also talked about, because we know who we are. We fundamentally believe that everyone is a child of God. And if we have inspiration and have prayed about it and know that what we're doing is the right thing, that is such a thick layer of armor and protection against these arrows that are coming at us, that I think people need to recognize that and realize that they can do it. And if they feel like they're called to do this and that, you know, this is something that Heavenly Father wants them to do, then they are going to be thick-skinned enough. They will be able to do that hard thing and rise to the occasion.
And also that you don't have to jump into the deep end. You can just start wading in. I started in Belmont. I mean, I do lots and lots of different things. And we've really just talked about my local community service. I started by running for town meeting. And I did that because a friend in the neighborhood encouraged me to do so. And then that turned into the warrant committee. And as the warrant committee, the first year or two, I didn't know a thing. And now I've been on it long enough that I know a whole lot about local pensions and town administration and property taxes. You know, I've taken on these issues that I've become proficient in. And then that led to the community preservation committee. And as chair of the committee, I really felt lost, but you just keep doing it. And so these things grow, and others will have the same experience where you start with your toe and then maybe you're up to your ankle and then maybe you're up to your knee, but you don't have to jump into the deep end. You can pick little pieces. You can bite off manageable chunks.
So I just got put on my community recognition committee. And it's just this small committee that recognized great people in our community. And I'm so excited about it. And it was what I had time to do right now. And I haven't been to a single meeting yet, so I don't know exactly what it entails. But, you know, things like that are a good way to dip your toes in, because there are all these committees and groups and organizations in your community that need people, and they need good, solid people who can compromise and talk to others and get things done. And LDS women are so good at that. So I think if we're willing to kind of do a little research in our community and look and see what positions might be available, there's so much good we can do. And if we want to expand that later, that's great. If not, you stay on the community recognition committee, you know?
Well, and the minute you said that, I thought, oh, that's a brilliant place to be, because in meeting people or wanting to recognize people, you'll also find out the projects they're working on. Mm-hmm. You're going to also be working with, at various points, officials in the town. So it's giving you all these points of intersection and contact that then mm-hmm. might lead to something. something else. Again, going back to the questions that you asked, advice I'd give my 20-year-old self.
I love it.
The first thing that I'd say, and again, this is specific to LDS women, we are so hard on ourselves. The advice that I would give myself is understand you really can't do it all. For so many years, I prioritized my children despite a trajectory that looked like it was going one way. Mm-hmm. I have a son with autism, and that really forced a 180 in my career, as well as location. I somehow thought that if I just worked harder, faster, smarter, I could cram 48 hours into 24. Nobody has it all. And frankly, as a church, we sometimes hold up these women saying, oh, they do have it all. I can guarantee they don't. There's a spouse behind them who's taken a back seat, or unfortunately, and I don't mean to condemn people who are you know, not pursuing motherhood as their primary focus, but I've seen a lot of children not do very well. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't something that I could or would do. And yet the whole time I was raising my children, I felt like a failure. And I think we just need to be kind and recognize our limits. God doesn't want any of us to be miserable. And the other thing that I did know and yet probably didn't fully appreciate is for some things you really do need a plan. Mm-hmm. I was not headed toward the Supreme Court, but if I'd wanted to go to the Supreme Court, I needed to make sure that I had lined myself up to have clerkships with district and appellate judges at the federal level. You just don't jump to being a Supreme Court clerk. And I happen to be thinking of that because I was talking with Judge Tom Griffith last month, who has played with a lot of Supreme Court clerks. And so I'm not saying that's an opportunity that I missed, but you need to understand there are things that you have to do. If my goal had been truly, truly to run for the Senate or the House of Representatives, I probably needed to have said to my husband, hey, we can't stay in Massachusetts. We need to go somewhere else, mm-hmm. where this actually happened for me. You always need a plan. That plan needs to be flexible because very rarely will your plan unfold as you hope, but what your plan will do is put you in the path of opportunity, yeah. and the flow of ideas. Even if you are prioritizing children right now, we live long and well. So be doing things now that prepare you for Act 3. And that's kind of where I am right now. I think I'm about to launch into much more. My last just graduated from high school last week. And I've had my fingers in so many pies. But now that I feel like this really is behind me, not behind because you never stop parenting, but that the time that it's going to take is much less, I can consolidate a lot of this and really look at Act 3, whatever mm-hmm. that's going to be. Are there further questions that come out of that? I feel like I just monologued.
Well, I mean, that was fantastic. I feel like we're running low on time. So I want to ask you before we go, because you were telling me about this thing that you're involved in that deals with US-UK relations. And I'm fascinated by that. And I want to hear more about it. So if you can just tell us a little bit about what you do there. I know you've got your hands all over and doing all kinds of great stuff, but we're going to have to schedule another podcast because I also want to talk to you about some other things. So we're going to do that too.
So I mentioned that I went to the University of Cambridge as a Marshall Scholar, and the Marshall Scholarships were set up by the UK government as a thank you for the Marshall Plan, which is where the United States invested billions of dollars to rebuild the post-war economies of Europe and England. And 5 or 6 years ago, looked at it and thought, we don't have an endowment, unlike the Rhodes or the Gates or the Schwarzman Scholarships, all of which have these huge endowments. We are a line item in the annual budget if you take up. So in a time of austerity, that can be really fragile. Yeah. And so about 6 years ago, some Marshall alums banded together. We had something called the Association of Marshall Scholars, which was the alumni organization, but decided that we were going to professionalize. So we've hired an executive director, Nell Breyer, who is the daughter of Justice Stephen Breyer, who is a Marshall Scholar, as is Neil Gorsuch, who was a classmate of mine, actually. We went over the same year. But our primary focus was preserving the scholarship. Mm-hmm. But as part of doing this, we also focus on programming and especially US-UK relations at a very high level. The Marshall Scholarship looms much larger in the American consciousness than it does in the British consciousness. And they really had no idea the massive amounts of return investment they've received, and the high levels at which marshals penetrate the federal government and state government as well. So our job has been to quantify for them all the ways that, this has given back. And we can literally show that dollar for dollar, it's had a massive multiplier effect, that just through donations back to Cambridge University and Oxford, every penny the government has ever spent, those donations far exceed. Ray Dolby was a marshal of Dolby Stereos, and he gave a massive donation. Reed Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn, is a marshal. You know, we can point to all these people who've just given huge dollars back to the British government. So long story short, I was there. We about 6 weeks ago were at the Supreme Court. And the UK's Supreme Court is pretty recent. It was really only formed in about 2011, and it's not nearly as powerful as ours. But we brought a big delegation of UK justices over to meet with the Supreme Court. And they literally had these discussions of rule of law and how this works. And so this very high level interaction in really important ways. And my job, frankly, is I call it to chat and charm. So I do a lot of fundraising, and then I do a lot of lobbying. And so then a couple of weeks after that, I was in, actually just 2 weeks ago, I was in London at the same time as the Platinum Jubilee, again, for some very high level meetings at Lancaster House with the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office. And I was assigned, because my job is to chat and charm, to sit at a table with the woman who is head of their foreign scholarship program. And at the end, she said two things. I just said, we're trying to quantify for you how much you've received back. And after a presentation on Ray Dolby and Dolby Stereos and how all his research came out of what he did as a Marshall Scholar at the University of Cambridge, these technical breakthroughs. And then we talked about how much just he'd given back. She looked at me and said, point taken. At the end of this meeting, she said to me, what would an endowment look like? And I said, funny you should ask, but this has been the culmination of 6 years of work by many of us. I mean, there are many, many people who've been involved in this effort. I'm on the board of directors, and I'm chair of the annual fund, the fundraising arm, but it's been many, many people who've been involved in this. And especially given what's going on with Europe and Russia and Ukraine and Brexit, we all need international friends right now. And the UK, there is a special relationship there. They have been our longest allies and friends. And there is this common shared history of the rule of law and common law, and rights under the law. But so that's actually really, really satisfying as well. And again, I'm never going to be the headline on any of this, but at the end of the day, I know that my efforts mattered. And I think that's really what all of us want. We want to know that what we do matters, that it's made a difference. And I don't think most of us need, despite Facebook and the fact that sometimes feel like you don't exist if you're not on social media, there is tremendous satisfaction at the end of the day that comes from knowing, hey, I did something really important and I helped. And nobody can take that away from you. And again, that's, I said that sometimes we get our inspiration from God, but that's also the gift that we lay down on the altar. Just say, hey, Lord, I did this thing and I feel good about it. And thank you that I could serve. And here it is. This is my gift.
I love that. And that sounds amazing, what you're getting to do. And I love how you ended that nobody can take that away from you when you know you've done something good. And whether you're getting big public accolades for it, that's not what's important. It's that you know you did good and you made a difference. And that feeling is really incredible.
Which can be a segue into all my special education advocacy, which could be another...
Yes, we will talk again for sure. But we are out of time. I wanted to ask you if you had an invitation for our listeners today.
Sure. I think there's always an invitation to just start to become aware of what's going on around you, whether it's the local, the state, or the federal level. Freedom isn't free. We're only free as long as we're vigilant. And I didn't go into this, but there sometimes some of the things that happen at the local level aren't nice. I've been highly involved in watching over our pension funds. There is some legal corruption. It's corrupt, but it's legal. It's going on. And you need to be eyes and ears. And that it is really important. And if not you, then who? So please just jump in. You can do it. You can do it at a level that works for you, but please get involved.
Yeah. I love it. Thank you so much. This was such a fantastic conversation. This was the easiest podcast I've ever done. You just answered all my questions without me even having to ask all of them. So I thank you. You're a fantastic guest. I can't wait to get this posted. And for all of our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We will have another podcast for you in a couple of weeks. And if you like this podcast or any of our other podcasts, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. We'd really appreciate it. And we will see you next time.